or her small nephew. He looked tiny and frail in the large bed. Benedict and Sophie had had him moved to their bedchamber, where there was more room for people to tend to him. His skin was flushed, but his eyes, when he opened them, were glassy and unfocused, and when he wasn't lying unnaturally still, he was thrashing about, mumbling incoherently about ponies and tree houses and marzipan candy. It made Eloise wonder what she would mumble incoherently about, were she ever to be gripped by a fever. She mopped his brow, and she turned him and helped the maids change his sheets, and she didn't notice as the sun slipped below the horizon. She just thanked the heavens that Charles did not worsen under her care, because according to the servants, Benedict and Sophie had been at his side for 2 days straight, and Eloise did not want to have to wake either of them up with bad news. She sat in the chair by the bed, and she read to him from his favourite book of children's tales, and she told him stories of when his father was young, and she doubted that he heard a word, but it all made her feel better, because she couldn't just sit there and do nothing. And it wasn't until 8 in the evening, when Sophie finally rose from her stupor and asked after Philip, that it occurred to her that she ought to send a note, that he might be growing worried. So she scrawled something short and hasty and resumed her vigil. Philip would understand. By 8 in the evening, Philip realized that one of two things had happened to his wife. She had either perished in a carriage accident or she had left him. Neither prospect was terribly appealing. He didn't think she would have left him. She seemed mostly happy in their marriage, despite their quarrel that afternoon, and besides, she hadn't taken any of her belongings with her, although that didn't mean much. Most of her belongings had yet to arrive from her home in London. It wasn't as if she'd be leaving much behind here at Romney Hall. Just a husband and 2 children. Good God! And he'd just said to them this afternoon, "I do believe she's here to stay." No, he thought savagely. Eloise would not leave him. She would never do such a thing. She didn't have a cowardly bone in her body, and she would never slink off and abandon their marriage. If she was displeased in some way, she'd tell him so, right to his face and without mincing words. Which, he realized, yanking on his coat as he practically hurled himself out the front door, meant that she was dead in some ditch on the Wiltshire Road. It had been raining steadily all evening, and the roads between his house and Benedict's were not well tended to begin with. Hell, it would almost be better if she'd left him. But as he rode up the drive to My Cottage, Benedict Bridgerton's absurdly named house, soaking wet and in a terrible temper, it was starting to look more like Eloise had decided to abandon her marriage, because she hadn't been lying in a ditch by the side of the road, and there hadn't been any sign of any sort of carriage accident. And furthermore, she hadn't been holed up at either of the 2 inns along the way. And as there was only one route between his home and Benedict's, it wasn't as if she were in some other inn, on some other road, and this entire farce could be chalked up to nothing more than a big misunderstanding. "Temper," he said under his breath, as he stomped up the front steps. "Temper," because he had never been so close to losing his. Maybe there was a logical explanation. Maybe she hadn't wanted to drive home in the rain. It wasn't that bad, but it was more than a drizzle, and he supposed she might not have cared to travel. He lifted up the knocker on the door and slammed it down, hard. Maybe the carriage had broken a wheel. He banged the knocker again. No, that couldn't explain it. Benedict could easily have sent her home in his carriage. Maybe... His mind searched fruitlessly for some other reason why she would be here with her brother and not at home with her husband. He couldn't think of one. The curse that hissed out of his mouth was one he had not uttered in years. He reached up for the knocker again, this time prepared to yank the damned thing off the door and hurl it through the window. But just then the door opened, and Philip found himself staring at Graves, whom he had met less than a fortnight earlier, during his farce of a courtship.
"My wife?"
Philip practically growled. "Sir Philip!" the butler gasped. Philip didn't move, even though the rain was streaming down his face. Damned house didn't have a portico. Who ever heard of such a thing? In England, of all places. "My wife," he bit off again. "She's here," Graves assured him. "Come in." Philip stepped in. "I want my wife," he said again. "Now." "Let me get your coat," Graves said. "I don't give a damn about my coat," Philip snapped. "I want my wife." Graves froze, his hands still poised to take Philip's coat. "Did you not receive Lady Crane's note?" "No, I did not receive a note." "I thought you'd arrived rather quickly," Graves murmured. "You must have crossed with the messenger. You'd better come in." "I am in," Philip reminded him testily. Graves let out a long breath, almost a sigh, which was remarkable for a butler bred not to show even a hint of emotion. "I think you will be here for some time," he said softly. "Take off your coat. Get dry. You will want to be comfortable." Philip's anger suddenly slid into bone-deep terror. Had something happened to Eloise? Good God, if anything... "What is going on?" he whispered. He'd just found his children. He wasn't ready to lose his wife. The butler just turned to the stairs with sad eyes. "Come with me," he said softly. Philip followed, each step filling him with dread. Eloise had, of course, attended church nearly every Sunday of her life. It was what was expected of her, and it was what good, honest people did. But in truth, she'd never been a particularly God-fearing or religious sort. Her mind tended to wander during the sermons, and she sang along with the hymns, not out of any great sense of spiritual uplifting, but rather because she very much liked the music, and church was the only acceptable place for a tin ear like herself to raise her voice in song. But now, tonight, as she looked down upon her small nephew, she prayed. Charles hadn't worsened, but he hadn't improved, and the doctor, who had come and gone for the second time that day, had pronounced it in God's hands. Eloise hated that phrase, hated how doctors resorted to it when faced with illness beyond their skills. But if the physician was correct, and it was indeed in God's hands, then by the heavens above, that was to whom she would appeal. When she wasn't placing a cooling cloth on Charles's forehead, or spooning lukewarm broth down his throat, that was. But there was only so much to be done, and most of her time in the sick room was spent rather helplessly in vigil. And so she just sat there, her hands folded tightly in her lap, whispering, "Please, please." And then, as if the wrong prayer had been answered, she heard a noise in the doorway. And somehow it was Philip, even though she'd only sent the messenger an hour earlier. He was soaked from the rain, his hair plastered inelegantly against his forehead. But he was the dearest sight she'd ever seen, and before she had a clue what she was doing, she'd run across the room and thrown herself into his arms. "Oh, Philip!" she sobbed, finally allowing herself to cry. She'd been so strong all day, forcing herself to be the rock that her brother and sister-in-law needed. But now Philip was here, and as his arms came around her, he felt so solid and good, and for once she could allow someone else to be strong for her. "I thought it was you," Philip whispered. "What?" she asked, confused. "The butler. He didn't explain until we were up the stairs. I thought it was..." He shook his head. "Never mind." Eloise said nothing, just looked up at him, a tiny, sad smile on her face. "How is he?" he asked. She shook her head. "Not good." He looked over at Benedict and Sophie, who had risen to greet him. They looked rather not good as well. "How long has he been this way?" Philip asked.
2 days,
Benedict replied.
2 and a half, Sophie corrected. "Since Saturday morning. You need to get dry,"
Eloise said, pulling away from him. "And now I do, too." She looked ruefully down at her dress, now soaked through the front from Philip's wet clothing. "You'll end up in no better a state than Charles."
"I'm fine," Philip said,
brushing past her as he came to the little boy's bedside. He touched his forehead, then shook his head and glanced back at his parents.
"I can't tell," he said. "I'm too cold from the rain." "He's feverish," Benedict confirmed grimly.
"What have you done for him?" Philip asked. "Do you know something of medicine?" Sophie asked, her eyes filling with desperate hope.
"The doctor bled him," Benedict answered. "It didn't seem to help."
"We've been giving him broth," Sophie said, "and cooling him when he grows too hot, and warming him when he grows too cold," Eloise finished miserably. "Nothing seems to work," Sophie whispered, and then, in front of everyone, she simply crumpled, collapsed against the side of the bed and sobbed.
"Sophie," Benedict choked out.
He dropped to his knees beside her and held her as she wept, and Philip and Eloise both looked away as they realized that he was crying too.
"Willow bark tea," Philip said to Eloise. "Has he had any?"
"I don't think so. Why?"
"It's something I learned at Cambridge. It used to be given for pain, before laudanum became so popular. One of my professors insisted that it also helped to reduce fever."
"Did you give the tea to Marina?" Eloise asked.
Philip looked at her in surprise, then remembered that she still thought Marina had died of lung fever, which, he supposed, was mostly true.
"I tried," he answered, "but I couldn't get much down her throat. And besides, she was much sicker than Charles."
He swallowed, remembering.
"In many ways."
Eloise looked up into his face for a long moment, then turned briskly to Benedict and Sophie, who were quiet now, but still kneeling on the floor together, lost in their private moment. Eloise, however, being Eloise, had little reverence for private moments at such a time, and so grabbed her brother's shoulder and turned him around.
"Do you have any willow bark tea?" she asked him.
Benedict just looked at her, blinking, and then finally said,
"I don't know."
"Mrs. Crabtree might," Sophie said,
referring to one half of the old couple who had cared for my cottage before Benedict had married, when it had been nothing more than an occasional place for him to lay his head.
"She always has things like that. But she and Mr. Crabtree went to visit their daughter. They won't be home for several days."
"Can you get into their house?" Philip asked. "I will recognize it if she has it. It won't be a tea, just the bark, which we'll soak in hot water. It might help to bring down the fever."
"Willow bark?" Sophie asked doubtfully. "You mean to cure my son with the bark of a tree?"
"It certainly can't hurt him now,"
Benedict said gruffly, striding toward the door.
"Come along, Crane. We have a key to their cottage. I will take you there myself."
But as he reached the doorway, he turned to Philip and asked,
"Do you know what you're about?"
Philip answered the only way he knew how.
"I don't know. I hope so."
Benedict stared him in the face, and Philip knew that the older man was taking his measure. It was one thing for Benedict to allow him to marry his sister. It was quite another to let him force strange potions down his son's throat. But Philip understood. He had children too.
"Very well," Benedict said. "Let's go."
And as Philip hurried out of the house, all he could do was pray that Benedict Bridgerton's trust in him had not been misplaced. In the end, it was difficult to say whether it was the willow bark or Eloise's whispered prayers or just dumb luck. But by the following morning, Charles's fever had broken, and although the boy was still weak and listless, he was indubitably on the mend. By noontime, it was clear that Eloise and Philip were no longer needed, and in fact were getting in the way, and so they climbed into their carriage and headed home, both eager to collapse into their large, sturdy bed, and, for once, do nothing but sleep. The first 10 minutes of the ride home was spent in silence. Eloise, astonishingly, found herself too tired to speak. But even in her exhaustion, she was too restless, too tightly wound from the stress and worry of the previous night to sleep. And so she contented herself with staring out the window at the dampened countryside. It had stopped raining right about the time Charles's fever broke, suggesting a divine intervention that might have pointed to Eloise's prayers as the young boy's saviour. But as Eloise stole a glance at her husband, sitting beside her in the carriage with his eyes closed, although not, she was quite certain, asleep, she knew it was the willow bark. She didn't know how she knew, and she was quite cognizant of the fact that she could never prove it, but her nephew's life had been saved by a cup of tea. And to think how unlikely it was that Philip had even been at her brother's house that evening. It had been quite a singular chain of events. If she hadn't gone in to see the twins, if she hadn't gone to tell Philip that she didn't like their nurse, if they hadn't quarrelled. Put that way, little Charles Bridgerton was quite the luckiest little boy in Britain.
"Thank you," she said, not realising that she'd intended to speak until the words left her lips.
"For what?"
Philip murmured sleepily, without opening his eyes. "Charles," she said simply. Philip did open his eyes at that, and he turned to her.
"It might not have been my doing. We'll never know if it was the willow bark."
"I know," she said firmly. His lips curved into the barest of smiles.
"You always do."
And she thought to herself, was this what she'd been waiting for her entire life? Not the passion, not the gasps of pleasure she felt when he joined her in bed, but this sense of comfort, of easy companionship, of sitting next to someone in a carriage and knowing with every fibre of your being that it was where you belonged. She placed her hand on his. "It was so awful," she said, surprised that she had tears in her eyes. "I don't think I have ever been so scared in my life. I can't imagine what it must have been like for Benedict and Sophie."
"Nor I," Philip said softly.
"If it had been one of our children," she said, and she realised it was the first time she'd said that. Our children.
Philip was silent for a long time. When he spoke, he was looking out the window.
"The entire time I was watching Charles," he said, his voice suspiciously hoarse, "all I kept thinking was, thank God it's not Oliver or Amanda."
And then he turned back to her, his face pinched with guilt.
"But it shouldn't be anyone's child."
Eloise squeezed his hand.
"I don't think there is anything wrong with such feelings. You're not a saint, you know. You're just a father. A very good one, I think."
He looked at her with an odd expression, and then he shook his head.
"No," he said gravely. "I'm not, but I hope to be."
She cocked her head.
"Philip?"
"You were right," he said, his mouth tightening into a grim line. "About their nurse. I didn't want anything to be wrong, and so I paid no attention. But you were right. She was beating them."
"What?"
"With a book,"
he continued, his voice almost dispassionate, as if he'd already used up all of his emotions.
"I walked in and she was beating Amanda with a book. She had already finished with Oliver."
"Oh, no,"
Eloise said, as tears of sorrow and anger filled her eyes.
"I never dreamed. I didn't like her, of course, and she'd wrapped them on the knuckles, but I've been wrapped on the knuckles. Everyone has been wrapped on the knuckles."
She slumped in her seat, guilt weighing her shoulders down.
"I should have realised. I should have seen."
Philip snorted.
"You've barely been in residence a fortnight. I've been living with that bloody woman for months. If I didn't see, why should you have done?"
Eloise had nothing to say to this. Nothing, at least, that would not make her already guilt-ridden husband feel worse.
"I assume you dismissed her," she finally said.
He nodded.
"I told the children you would help to find a replacement.
"Of course," she said quickly. "And I..."
He stopped, cleared his throat, and looked out the window before continuing.
"I..."
"What is it, Philip?" she asked softly.
He didn't turn back to her when he said, "I'm going to be a better father. I've pushed them away for too long. I was so afraid of becoming my father, of being like him, that I..."
"Philip," Eloise murmured, laying her hand on his, "you're not like your father. You could never be."
"No," he said, his voice hollow. "But I thought I could. I got a whip once. I went to the stables and I grabbed the whip."
His head fell into his hands.
"I was so angry. So bloody angry."
"But you didn't use it," she whispered, knowing that her words were true. They had to be. He shook his head.
"But I wanted to."
"But you didn't," she said again, keeping her voice as firm as she was able.
"I was so angry,"
he said again, and she wasn't even sure he'd heard her. So lost was he in his own memory. But then he turned to her, and his eyes pierced hers.
"Do you understand what it is to be terrified by your own anger?"
She shook her head.
"I'm not a small man, Eloise," he said. "I could hurt someone."
"So could I," she replied. And then, at his dry look, she added, "Well, maybe not you, but I'm certainly big enough to hurt a child."
"You would never do that,"
he grunted, turning away. "Neither would you," she repeated. He was silent, and then, suddenly, she understood. "Philip," she said softly, "you said you were angry, but with whom were you angry?" He looked at her uncomprehendingly.
"They glued their governess's hair to the sheets, Eloise."
"I know," she said, with a dismissive wave of her hand. "I'm quite certain I would have wanted to throttle them both had I been present. But that's not what I asked." She waited for him to make some sort of response. When he did not, she added, "Were you angry with them because of the glue? Or were you angry with yourself because you didn't know how to make them mind?" He didn't say anything, but they both knew the answer. Eloise reached out and touched his hand. "You're nothing like your father, Philip," she repeated. "Nothing."
"I know that now," Philip said softly. "You have no idea how badly I wanted to tear that bloody Nurse Edwards from limb to limb."
"I can imagine," Eloise said, snorting as she settled back in her seat. Philip felt his lips twitch. He had no idea why, but there was something almost funny in his wife's tone, something comforting even. Somehow they had found humour in a situation where there ought not to be any, and it felt good. "She deserved nothing less," Eloise added with a shrug, and then she turned and looked at him. "But you didn't touch her, did you?" He shook his head.
"No. And if I manage to keep my temper with her, then I'm damn well not ever going to lose it with my children."
"Of course not," Eloise said, as if it had never been an issue. She patted his hand, then glanced out the window, clearly unconcerned. Such faith in him, Philip realized. Such faith in his inner goodness, in the quality of his soul, when he'd been racked by doubt for so many years. And then he felt he had to be honest, had to come clean, and before he knew what he was about, he blurted out,
"I thought you'd left me."
"Last night?" She turned to him in shock. "Why ever would you think that?" He shrugged self-deprecatingly.
"Oh, I don't know. It might be because you left for your brother's house and never came back."
She humphed at that. "It's clear now why I was detained. And besides, I would never leave you. You should know that." He quirked a brow.
"Should I?"
"Of course you should," she said, looking rather cross with him. "I made a vow in that church, and I assure you I do not take such things lightly. Besides, I made a commitment to Oliver and Amanda to be their mother,
and I would never turn my back on that.
Philip regarded her steadily, then murmured, No, no, you wouldn't. Silly of me not to have thought of that. She sat back and crossed her arms.
Well, you should have done. You know me better than that.
And then, when he did not say anything more, she added,
Those poor children. They have already lost one mother through no fault of their own. I'm certainly not going to run off and make them go through all that again.
She turned to him with a supremely irritated expression.
I cannot believe you even thought that of me.
Philip was beginning to wonder the same thing himself. He'd only known Eloise. Dear God, could it possibly have been only 2 weeks? It felt, in many ways, like a lifetime, because he did feel he knew her, inside and out. She'd always have her secrets, of course, as all people did, and he was quite certain he'd never understand her, since he couldn't imagine ever understanding anyone female. But he knew her. He was quite certain he knew her, and he should have known better than to have worried that she'd abandoned their marriage. It must have been panic, pure and simple, and, he supposed, because it was better to think she'd left him than to imagine her dead in a ditch by the side of the road. With the former, he could at least storm her brother's house and drag her home. If she'd died, he was unprepared for the pain he felt in his gut at the mere thought. When had she come to mean so much to him? And what was he going to do to keep her happy? Because he needed her happy. Not just, as he'd been telling himself, because a happy Eloise meant that his life would continue to run smoothly. He needed her happy, because the mere thought of her unhappy was like a knife in his heart. The irony was well aimed indeed. He'd told himself, over and over, that he'd married her to be a mother to his children. But just now, when she'd declared that she would never leave their marriage, that her commitment to the twins was too strong, he'd felt jealous. He'd actually felt jealous of his own children. He'd wanted her to mention the word wife, and all he'd heard was mother. He wanted her to want him. Him. Not just because she'd made a vow in a church, but because she was quite convinced she could not live without him. Maybe even because she loved him. Loved him. Dear God, when had this happened? When had he come to want so much from marriage? He'd married her to mother his children. They both knew that. And then there was the passion. He was a man, for God's sake, and he'd not lain with a woman for 8 years. How could he not be drunk on the feel of Eloise's skin next to his, on the sound of her whimpers and moans when she exploded around him, on the pure force of his own pleasure every time he entered her? He'd found everything he'd ever wanted in a marriage. Eloise ran his life to perfection by day and warmed his bed with the skill of a courtesan by night. She fulfilled his every desire so well that he hadn't noticed that she'd done something more. She'd found his heart. She'd touched it, changed it, changed him. He loved her. He hadn't been looking for love, hadn't even given a thought to it. But there it was, and it was the most precious thing imaginable. He was at the dawn of a new day, the first page of a new chapter of his life. It was thrilling and terrifying, because he did not want to fail. Not now, not when he'd finally found everything he needed. Eloise, his children, himself. It had been years since he'd felt comfortable in his own skin, since he'd trusted his instincts, since he'd looked in the mirror without avoiding his own gaze. He glanced out the window. The carriage was slowing down, pulling up alongside Romney Hall. Everything looked grey. The skies, the stone of the house, the windows, which reflected the clouds. Even the grass seemed a little less green without the sun to brighten its hue. It suited his contemplative mood perfectly. A footman appeared to help Eloise down, and once Philip had hopped down beside her, she turned to him and said,
I'm exhausted. and you look the same. Shall we go take a nap?"
He was just about to agree, since he was exhausted. But then, just before the words could leave his lips, he shook his head and said, "You go along without me." She opened her mouth to question him, but he silenced her with a gentle squeeze on her shoulder. "I'll be up shortly," he said. "But right now, I think I want to hug my children."
Chapter 18. "I do not tell you often enough, dear mother, how very grateful I am that I am yours. It is a rare parent who would offer a child such latitude and understanding. It is an even rarer one who calls a daughter friend. I do love you, dear mamma."
From Eloise Bridgerton to her mother, upon refusing her sixth offer of marriage. When Eloise awoke from her nap, she was surprised to see that the sheets on the other side of the bed were neat and unrumpled. Philip had been just as tired as she had been, probably more so, since he had ridden all the way to Benedict's house the night before, in the wind and rain no less. After she'd tidied herself, she set about to locate him, but he was nowhere to be found. She told herself not to worry, that they'd had a difficult few days, that he probably just needed some time to himself to think. Just because she tended not to prefer solitude didn't mean everyone else agreed with her. She laughed humorlessly to herself. That was a lesson she'd been trying, unsuccessfully, to learn her entire life. And so she forced herself to stop looking for him. She was married now, and suddenly she understood what it was her mother had been trying so hard to tell her on her wedding night. Marriage was about compromise, and she and Philip were very different people. They might be perfect for one another, but that didn't mean they were the same. And if she wanted him to change some of his ways for her, well then, she was going to have to do the same for him. She didn't see him for the rest of the day. Not when she took tea in the afternoon, not when she bade the twins good night, and not at supper, which she was forced to take by herself, feeling very small and very alone at the large mahogany table. She dined in silence, ever aware of the watchful eyes of the footman, both of whom smiled at her sympathetically as they brought forth her food. Eloise smiled back, because she did believe in being polite in all things, but inside she was sighing with resignation. It was a sad state of affairs when the footmen, men for goodness sakes, who were normally oblivious to another's distress, felt sorry for you. But then again, here she was, only 1 week into her marriage and dining alone. Who wouldn't have pitied her? Besides, the last the servants knew, Sir Philip had raged out the door to fetch his wife, who had presumably fled to her brother's house after a horrible row. Put that way, Eloise thought with a sigh, it wasn't quite so surprising that Philip might have thought she'd left him. She ate sparingly, not wanting to prolong the meal any longer than was necessary, and when she finished her obligatory 2 bites of pudding, she rose, fully intending to take herself off to bed, where, she presumed, she would pass her time as she had all day, alone. But as she stepped into the hall, she found herself restless, not quite ready to retire. And so she began to walk, somewhat aimlessly, through the house. It was a chilly night for late May, and she was glad she'd brought a shawl. Eloise had spent time in many grand country homes, where all the fireplaces were lit at night, leaving the house in a blaze of light and warmth. But Romney Hall, while snug and comfortable, held no such delusions of self-importance, and so most of the rooms were kept closed off for the night, with the fireplaces only lit when needed. And blast it, it was cold! She pulled her shawl closer around her shoulders as she walked along, rather enjoying finding her way with only the dim moonlight to guide her. But then, as she approached the portrait gallery, she saw the unmistakable light of a lantern. Someone was there, and she knew, even before she'd taken another step forward, that it was Philip. She approached quietly, glad that she'd worn her soft-soled slippers, and peered through the doorway. The sight she saw nearly broke her heart. Philip was standing there, stock still, in front of Marina's portrait. He moved not at all, save for the occasional blink of his eyes. He just stood there, looking at her, looking at his dead wife, and the expression on his face was so bleak and sorrowful that Eloise almost gasped. Had he lied to her when he'd said that he hadn't loved Marina? When he'd said he hadn't felt passion? And did it matter? Marina was dead. It wasn't as if she was a true competitor for Philip's affections. And even if she was, did it matter? Because he didn't love Eloise either, and she didn't. Or maybe, she realized, in one of those flashes that knock the very breath from one's lungs, she did. It was hard to imagine when it had happened, or even how it had happened. But this feeling she had for him, this affection and respect, had grown into something deeper. And oh, how she wanted him to feel the same way. He needed her. Of that she was quite sure. He needed her maybe even more than she needed him. But that wasn't it. She loved being needed, being wanted, being indispensable even. But there was more to her feelings. She loved the way he smiled, slightly lopsided, a little boyish, and with a little lilt of surprise, as if he couldn't quite believe in his own happiness. She loved the way he looked at her, as if she were the most beautiful woman in the world, when she knew quite patently that she was not. She loved the way he actually listened to what she had to say, and the way he didn't allow her to cow him. She even loved the way he told her she talked too much, because he almost always did it with a smile, and because, of course, it was true. And she loved the way he still listened to her, even after he told her she talked too much. She loved the way he loved his children. She loved his honour, his honesty, and his sly sense of humour. And she loved the way she fit into his life and the way he fit into hers. It was comfortable. It was right. And this, she finally realised, was where she belonged. But he was standing there, staring at a portrait of his dead wife. And from the way he was so still and unmoving, well, God only knew how long he'd been doing that. And if he still loved her, she choked back a wave of guilt. Who was she to feel anything but sorrow on behalf of Marina? She had died so young, so unexpectedly, and she'd lost what Eloise considered every mother's God-given right, to watch her children grow up. To feel jealous of a woman like that was unconscionable. And yet Eloise must not be as good a person as she ought, because she couldn't watch this scene, couldn't watch Philip staring at the portrait of his first wife without envy squeezing around her heart. She'd just realised she loved this man, and would to the very last of her days. She needed him, not a dead woman. No, she thought fiercely, he didn't still love Marina. Maybe he'd never loved Marina. He'd said the morning before that he hadn't been with a woman for 8 years. 8 years? It sank in, finally. Good God! She'd spent the past 2 days in such a flurry of emotion that she hadn't really stopped and thought, really thought about what he'd said. 8 years. It was not what she would have expected. Not from a man such as Philip, who clearly enjoyed, no, clearly needed, the physical aspects of married love. Marina had only been dead for 15 months. If Philip had gone without a woman for 8 years, that meant they hadn't shared a bedroom since the twins had been conceived. No. Eloise did some mental arithmetic. No, it would have been after the twins had been born. A little bit after. Of course, Philip could have been off in his dates, or perhaps exaggerating. But somehow Eloise didn't think so. She rather thought he knew exactly when he and Marina had last slept together, and she feared, especially now that she had pinpointed the date of it, that it had been a terrible occasion indeed. But he had not betrayed her. He had remained faithful to a woman from whose bed he'd been banned. Eloise wasn't surprised, given his innate sense of honour and dignity, but she didn't think she would have thought less of him if he had sought comfort elsewhere. And the fact that he hadn't, it made her love him all the more. But if his time with Marina had been so difficult and disturbing, why had he come here tonight? Why was he staring at her portrait, standing there as if he couldn't move from the spot, gazing upon her, as if he were pleading with her, begging her for something, begging the favour of a dead woman? Eloise couldn't stand it any longer. She stepped forward and cleared her throat. Philip surprised her by turning instantly. She thought that he was so completely lost in his own world that he would not hear her. He didn't say anything, not even her name. But then he held out his hand. She walked forward and took it, not knowing what else to do, not even knowing, as strange as it seemed, what to say. So she just stood beside him and stared up at Marina's portrait. "Did you love her?" she asked, even though she'd asked him before. "No," he said, and she realised that a small part of her must have still been very worried, because the rush of relief she felt at his denial was surprising in its force. "Do you miss her?" His voice was softer, but it was sure. "No." "Did you hate her?" she whispered. He shook his head, and he sounded very sad when he said, "No." She didn't know what else to ask, wasn't sure what she should ask. So she just waited, hoping he would speak. And after a very long while, he did.
"She was sad," he said. "She was always sad."
Eloise looked up at him, but he did not return the glance. His eyes were on Marina's portrait, as if he had to look at her while he spoke about her, as if, maybe, he owed her that.
"She was always sombre," he continued. "Always a bit too serene, if that makes any sense. But it was worse after the twins were born. I don't know what happened. The midwife said it was normal for women to cry after childbirth, but that I shouldn't worry, that it would clear away in a few weeks."
"But it didn't," Eloise said softly. He shook his head, then harshly brushed one dark lock of hair aside when it fell onto his brow.
"It just got worse. I don't know how to explain it. It was almost as if..."
He shrugged helplessly as he searched for words, and when he continued, he was whispering.
"It was almost as if she'd disappeared. She rarely left her bed. I never saw her smile. She cried a lot, a great deal."
The sentences came forth, not in a rush, but one at a time, as if each piece of information were being brought forth from his memory in slow succession. Eloise didn't say anything, didn't feel it her place to interrupt him, or to try to inject her feelings on a matter she knew nothing about. And then, finally, he turned away from Marina to Eloise and looked her squarely in the eye.
"I tried everything to make her happy. Everything in my power. Everything I knew. But it wasn't enough."
Eloise opened her mouth, made a small sound, the beginnings of a murmur meant to assure him that he'd done his best, but he cut her off.
"Do you understand, Eloise?"
he asked, his voice growing louder, more urgent.
"It wasn't enough."
"It wasn't your fault," she said softly, because even though she hadn't known Marina as an adult, she knew Philip, and she knew that had to be the truth.
"Eventually I just gave up," he said, his voice flat. "I stopped trying to help her at all. I was so sick and tired of beating my head against a wall where she was concerned, and all I tried to do was protect the children and keep them away when she was in a really bad spell, because they loved her so much.
He looked at her pleadingly, maybe for understanding, maybe for something else Eloise didn't understand.
She was their mother.
I know, she said softly.
She was their mother, and she didn't... she couldn't.
But you were there, Eloise said fervently. You were there. He laughed harshly.
Yes, and a fat lot of good that did them. It's one thing to be born with one dreadful parent, but to have two. I would never have wished that on my children. And yet, here we are.
You are not a bad father, Eloise said, unable to keep the scolding tone out of her voice. He just shrugged and turned back to the portrait, clearly unable to consider her words.
Do you know how much it hurt? He whispered. Do you have any idea?
She shook her head, even though he'd turned away.
To try so hard, so damned hard, and never succeed. Hell!
He laughed, a short, bitter sound, full of self-loathing.
Hell, he said again. I didn't even like her, and it hurt so much.
You didn't like her? Eloise asked, her surprise pitching her words into a different register. His lips quirked ironically.
Can you like someone you don't even know?
He turned back to her.
I didn't know her, Eloise. I was married to her for 8 years, and I never knew her.
Maybe she didn't let you know her.
Maybe I should have tried harder.
Maybe, Eloise said, infusing her voice with all the surety and conviction she could. There was nothing more you could have done. Some people are born melancholy, Philip. I don't know why, and I doubt anyone knows why, but that's just the way they are. He looked at her sardonically, his dark eyes clearly dismissing her opinion, and so she leapt back in with, Don't forget, I knew her too, as a child, long before you even knew she existed. Philip's expression changed then, and his gaze grew so intense upon her face that she nearly squirmed under the pressure of it. I never heard her laugh, Eloise said softly, not even once. I've been trying to remember her better since I met you, trying to recall why my memories of her always seemed so strange and odd. And I think that's it. She never laughed. Whoever heard of a child who doesn't laugh?
Philip was silent for a few moments. Then he said,
I don't think I ever heard her laugh either. Sometimes she would smile, usually when the children came to see her. But she never laughed.
Eloise nodded.
And then she said, I'm not Marina, Philip.
I know, he said. Believe me, I know. It's why I married you, you know.
It wasn't quite what she wanted to hear, but she stifled her disappointment and allowed him to continue. The creases in his forehead deepened, and he rubbed them hard. He looked so burdened, so tired of his responsibilities.
I just wanted someone who wasn't going to be sad, he said. Someone who would be present for the children. Someone who wouldn't...
He cut himself off, turned away.
Someone who wouldn't what?
She asked urgently, sensing that this was important. For the longest time, she thought he wasn't going to answer. But then, just when she'd quite given up on him, he said,
She died of influenza. You know that, don't you?
Yes, she said, since his back was to her and he wouldn't see her nod.
She died of influenza, he repeated. That's what we told everyone.
Eloise suddenly felt very sick, because she knew, absolutely knew what he was going to say.
Well, it was the truth,
he said bitterly, surprising her with his words. She'd been so sure he was going to say that they'd been lying all the while.
It's the truth, he said again, but it wasn't all of the truth. She did die of influenza, but we never told anyone why she fell ill.
The lake, Eloise whispered, her words coming forth unbidden. She hadn't even realized she'd been thinking them until she spoke. He nodded grimly.
She didn't fall in by accident.
Her hand flew to cover her mouth. No wonder he'd been so upset that she'd taken the children there. She felt awful. Of course she didn't know. Couldn't have known, but still.
I got her just in time, he said. Just in time to save her from drowning, that is. Not in time to save her from lung fever 3 days later.
He choked back bitter laughter.
Not even my famed willow bark tea could do the job for her.
I'm so sorry, Eloise whispered, and she was, even though Marina's death had, in so many ways, made her own happiness possible.
You don't understand, he said, not looking at her. You couldn't possibly.
I have never known someone who took their own life, she said cautiously, not certain if these were the words one was meant to say in such a situation.
That's not what I mean, he said,
almost snapped, really.
You don't know what it's like to feel trapped, stuck, hopeless, to try so hard and never, ever.
He turned to her then, and his eyes were flashing fire.
Break through. I tried. Every day I tried. I tried for me, and I tried for Marina, and most of all for Oliver and Amanda. I did everything I knew how. Everything everyone told me to do. And nothing, not one thing made it work. I tried, and she cried, and then I tried again and again and again. And all she ever did was dig herself deeper into her damned bed and pull up the covers over her head. She lived in darkness with her curtains drawn and the lights dimmed. And then she picked the one goddamn sunny day to go and kill herself.
Eloise's eyes widened.
A sunny day, he said. We'd had a bloody month of overcast skies, and then finally the sun came out, and she had to kill herself.
He laughed, but the sound was short and bitter.
After everything she'd done, she had to go and ruin sunny days for me.
Philip, Eloise said, placing her hand on his arm, but he just shook her off.
And if that weren't enough, she couldn't even kill herself properly.
Well, no, he said harshly.
I suppose that was my fault. She would have been quite good and dead if I hadn't come along and forced her to torture us all for 3 more days, wondering if she might live or die.
He crossed his arms and snorted in disgust.
But of course she died. I don't know why we even held out hope. She didn't fight it at all, didn't use even an ounce of energy to fight the illness. She just laid there and let it claim her, and I kept waiting for her to smile, as if she were finally happy, because now she'd succeeded in the one thing she wanted to do.
Oh, my God, Eloise whispered, sickened by the image. Did she? He shook his head.
No, she didn't have even the energy for that. She just died with the same expression on her face she always had. Empty.
I'm so sorry, Eloise said, even though she knew her words could never be enough. No one should have to go through something like that. He stared at her for the longest time, his eyes searching hers, looking for something, searching for an answer that she wasn't sure she had. Then he turned abruptly away and walked to the window, staring out at the inky night sky.
I tried so hard, he said,
his voice quiet with resignation and regret.
And still, every day, I wished I were married to someone else.
His head tipped forward until his forehead was leaning against the glass.
Anyone else.
He was silent for a very long time. Too long, in Eloise's estimation. And so she stepped forward, murmuring his name. Just to hear his response, just to know that he was all right.
Yesterday, he said, his voice abrupt, you said we have a problem.
No, she cut in, as quickly as she was able. I didn't mean...
You said we have a problem,
he repeated, his voice so low and forceful she didn't think he'd hear another interruption, even if she tried.
But until you live through what I lived through,
he continued,
until you've been trapped in a hopeless marriage to a hopeless spouse, until you've gone to bed alone for years, wishing for nothing more than the touch of another human being.
He turned around, stepped toward her, his eyes alight with a fire that humbled her.
Until you've lived through all that, he said,
don't
you ever complain about what we have. Because to me...
He choked on the words, but he barely paused before he continued.
This, us, is heaven, and I can't bear to hear you say otherwise.
Oh, Philip, she said, and then she did the only thing she knew to do. She closed the distance between them and threw her arms around him and held on for all she was worth.
I'm so sorry,
she murmured, her tears soaking into his shirt.
I'm so sorry.
I don't want to fail again,
he choked out, burying his face in the crook of her neck.
I can't. I couldn't.
You won't,
she vowed.
We won't.
You've got to be happy,
he said, his words sounding as if they'd been ripped from his throat.
You have to be. Please say.
I am,
she assured him.
I am, I promise you.
He pulled back and took her face in his hands, forcing her to look deeply into his eyes. He seemed to be searching for something in her expression, desperately seeking confirmation, or maybe absolution, or maybe just a simple promise.
I am happy,
she whispered, covering his hands with her own.
More than I ever dreamed possible. And I am proud to be your wife.
His face seemed to tighten, and his lower lip began to quiver. Eloise caught her breath. She'd never seen a man cry, never really even thought it possible. But then a tear rolled slowly down his cheek, settling into the dimple at the corner of his mouth, until she reached out and brushed it away.
I love you,
he said, choking on the words.
I don't even care if you don't feel the same way. I love you and...
Oh, Philip,
she whispered, reaching up and touching the tears on his face.
I love you too.
His lips moved as if trying to form words, and then he gave up on speech, and he reached out for her, crushing her to him with a strength and intensity that humbled her. He buried his face in her neck, murmuring her name over and over again, and then his words became kisses, and he moved along her skin until he found her mouth. How long they stood there, kissing as if the world were to end that very night, Eloise would never know. Then he swept her into his arms and carried her out of the portrait gallery and up the stairs, and before she knew it, she was on her bed and he was on top of her. And his lips had never left hers.
I need you,
he said hoarsely, pulling her dress from her body with shaking fingers.
I need you like I need breath. I need you like food, like water.
She tried to say she needed him too, but she couldn't. Not when his mouth had closed around her nipple. Not when he was sucking in such a way that made her feel it down in her belly. A warm, slow heat that curled and grew, taking her hostage until she could do nothing but reach for this man, her husband, and give herself to him with everything that she had. He lifted himself away from her, just long enough to yank off his own clothing, and then he rejoined her, this time lying beside her. He pulled her to him until they were belly to belly, and then he stroked her hair, softly, gently, and his other hand splayed at the small of her back.
I love you, he whispered. I want nothing more than to grab you and...
He swallowed.
You have no idea how much I want you right now.
Her lips curved.
I think I have some idea.
That made him smile.
My body is dying. It's like nothing I've ever felt, and yet... He leaned in closer and brushed his lips across hers. I had to stop. I had to tell you. She couldn't speak, could barely breathe, and she felt the tears coming, burning in her eyes until they spilled out, flowing over his hands. "Don't cry," he whispered.
"I can't help it," she said, her voice shaking. "I love you so much. I didn't think... I'd always hoped, but I guess I never really thought..."
"I never thought either," he said, and they both knew what they were thinking. "I never thought it would happen to me." "I'm so lucky," he said, and his hands moved, sliding down her ribcage, over her belly, and then around to her backside. "I think I've waited my entire life for you."
"I know I've been waiting for you,"
Eloise said. He squeezed and pulled her against him, nearly burning her with his touch. "I'm not going to be able to go slowly," he said, his voice shaking. "I think I used up my entire allotment of willpower just now."
"Don't go slowly," she said,
sliding onto her back and pulling him atop her. She spread her legs, opening until he settled between them, his sex coming to rest right at the opening of her womanhood. Her hands found his hair and sank in, pulling his head down until his mouth was right at hers.
"I don't want it slow," she said.
And then, in a single fluid motion, so fast that it took her breath away, he was inside her, embedded to the hilt, knocking against her womb with enough force to jolt a surprised little from her lips. He smiled wickedly. "You said you wanted it fast." She responded by curling her legs around his, locking him to her. She tilted her hips, which pulled him in even deeper, and smiled back.
"You're not doing anything," she said to him.
And then he did. All words were lost as they moved. They weren't graceful, and they didn't move as one. Their bodies weren't in tune, and the sounds they made were not musical or lovely. They just moved, with need and fire and total abandon, reaching for each other, reaching for the summit. The wait was not long. Eloise tried to make it last, tried to hold out, but there was no way. With every stroke, Philip unleashed a fire within her that could not be denied. And then finally, when she couldn't contain herself one moment longer, Eloise cried out and arched beneath him, lifting them both from the bed with the force of her fulfillment. Her body quivered and shook, and she gasped for breath, and all she could do was clutch his back, her fingers surely leaving bruises on his skin as she clung to him. And then, before she could even fall back down to earth, Philip cried out, and he slammed forward over and over again, emptying himself within her until he collapsed, the full weight of him pinning her into the mattress. But she didn't mind. She loved the feel of him atop her, loved the heaviness, loved the smell and the taste of the sweat on his skin. She loved him. It was that simple. She loved him, and he loved her. And if there was anything more, anything else important in her world, it just didn't matter. Not right there. Not right then. "I love you," he whispered, finally rolling off of her and allowing her lungs to fill with air. "I love you." It was all she needed. Chapter 19.
Days are filled with endless amusements. I shop and attend luncheons and pay calls and have calls paid upon me. In the evenings I usually attend a ball or musicale, or perhaps a smaller party. Sometimes I remain at home with my own company and read a book. Truly, it is a full and lively existence. I have no cause for complaint. What more, I often ask, could a lady want?
From Eloise Bridgerton to Sir Philip Crane, 6 months into their unusual correspondence. For the rest of her days,
Eloise would remember the following week as one of the most magical of her life. There were no stupendous events, no bursts of fine weather, no birthdays, no extravagant gifts or unexpected visitors. But still, even though it all seemed, on the outside at least, very ordinary, everything changed. It wasn't the sort of thing that hit one like a thunderbolt, or even, Eloise thought with a wry smile, like a slammed door or high C at the opera. It was a slow, creeping kind of change, the sort of thing that begins without one realizing it and ends before one even knows it has begun. It started a few mornings after she'd come across Philip in the portrait gallery. When she woke, he was sitting, fully dressed, at the foot of the bed, staring at her with an indulgent smile on his face.
"What are you doing there?" Eloise asked, tucking the sheets under her arms as she scooted into a sitting position.
"Watching you."
Her lips parted with surprise, and then she couldn't help but smile.
"It can't be very interesting."
"To the contrary. I can't think of anything that could keep my attention for so long."
She blushed, mumbling something about his being silly. But in truth, his words made her want to yank him right back into bed. She had a feeling he wouldn't resist. He never did. But she put a hold on her desire, since he had, after all, got himself completely dressed, and she rather thought he'd done so for a reason.
"I brought you a muffin," he said, holding out a plate.
Eloise thanked him and took his proffered dish. While she was munching away and wishing he'd thought to bring something to drink as well, he said,
"I thought we might go on an outing today."
"You and I?"
"Actually," he said, "I thought the four of us might go."
Eloise froze, her teeth lodged in the muffin, and looked at him. This was, she realized, the first time he'd suggested such a thing. The first time, to her knowledge at least, that he'd reached out to his children rather than setting them aside, hoping that someone else would see to them.
"I think that's a fine idea," she said softly.
"Good," he said, rising to his feet. "I'll leave you to your morning routine and inform that poor housemaid you bullied into acting as their nurse that we will be taking them for the day."
"I'm sure she'll be relieved,"
Eloise said. Mary hadn't really wanted to take the position as nursemaid, even on a temporary basis. None of the servants had. They all knew the twins too well. And poor, long-haired Mary vividly recalled having to burn the bedsheets after they'd been unable to remove the last governess's glued-on hair. But there was nothing else to be done, and Eloise had extracted a promise from both children that they would treat Mary with the respect due to, say, the Queen, and so far they had been living up to their word. Eloise even had her fingers crossed that Mary might relent and agree to the position on a permanent basis. It did pay better than cleaning, after all. Eloise looked over at the door and was surprised to see Philip standing quite still, frowning.
"What is wrong?" she asked.
He blinked, then looked in her direction, his brows still pulled down in thought.
"I'm not sure what to do."
"I believe the doorknob will turn in either direction," she teased.
He shot her a look, then said,
"There are no fairs or events occurring in the village. What should we do with them?"
"Anything," Eloise said, smiling at him with all the love in her heart. "Or nothing at all. It doesn't matter, really. All they want is you, Philip. All they want is you."
2 hours later, Philip and Oliver were standing outside the Larkins' fine tailor and dressmaker in the village of Tetbury, waiting, somewhat impatiently, while Eloise and Amanda completed their purchases inside.
"Did we have to go shopping?"
Oliver groaned, as if he'd been asked to wear pigtails and a frock. Philip shrugged.
"It is what your mother wished to do."
"Next time it's the men's turn to pick,"
Oliver grumbled.
"If I'd known having a mother would mean this..."
Philip had to force himself not to laugh.
"Men must make sacrifices for the women we love,"
he said in serious tones, patting his son on the shoulder.
It's the way of the world, I'm afraid.
Oliver let out a long, suffering sigh, as if he'd been making such sacrifices on a daily basis. Philip looked through the window. Eloise and Amanda showed no signs of wrapping up their business.
But as pertains to the issue of shopping, and who gets to decide upon the next joint activity, he said, I agree wholeheartedly.
Just then, Eloise poked her head outside.
Oliver, she asked, would you care to come in?
No,
Oliver replied, shaking his head emphatically. Eloise pursed her lips.
Allow me to rephrase, she said. Oliver, I would like you to come in.
Oliver looked up to his father, his eyes pleading.
I'm afraid you must do as she says, Philip said.
So many sacrifices,
Oliver grumbled, shaking his head as he hauled himself up the steps. Philip coughed to cover a laugh.
Are you coming too?
Oliver asked.
Hell no, Philip almost said, but managed to catch himself in time to change it to, I need to remain outside to watch the carriage.
Oliver's eyes narrowed.
Why does the carriage need watching?
Strain on the wheels, Philip mumbled. All our packages, you know.
He was unable to hear what Eloise said under her breath, but the tone was not complimentary.
Run along, Oliver, he said, patting his son on the back. Your mother needs you.
And you too,
Eloise said sweetly, just to torture him, he was sure.
You need new shirts.
Philip groaned.
Can't we have the tailor come out to the house?
Don't you want to choose the fabric?
He shook his head and said, quite grandly,
I trust you implicitly.
I think he needs to watch the carriage,
Oliver said, still hovering in the threshold.
He's going to need to watch his back, Eloise muttered. If he doesn't...
Oh, very well, Philip said. I'll come in, but only for a moment.
He found himself standing in the women's half of the shop, a frilly, feminine place, if ever there was one, and shuddered.
Anything more, and I'm likely to perish of claustrophobia.
A big, strong man like you, Eloise said in a mild voice. Nonsense.
And then she looked up at him and motioned to him with her chin to come close.
Yes?
He asked, wondering what this was all about.
Amanda,
she whispered, nodding toward a door at the back of the room.
When she comes out, make a fuss.
He looked about the store doubtfully. He might as well have been in China, so out of place did he feel.
I'm not very good at fussing.
Learn,
she ordered, then turned her attention to Oliver with a,
Now it's your turn, Master Crane. Mrs. Larkin.
Oliver's groan would have done a dying man justice.
I want Mr. Larkin,
he protested.
Like father.
You would like to see the tailor? Eloise asked. Oliver nodded vigorously.
Really?
He nodded again, although without quite as much conviction.
Even though,
Eloise continued, with enough inflection to put her on the Drury Lane stage,
not an hour ago you vowed that wild horses could not drag you inside a storefront unless there were guns or toy soldiers in the window.
Oliver's mouth went slack, but he nodded. Barely.
You're good,
Philip murmured in her ear, as he watched Oliver drag himself through the doorway that separated Mr. Larkin's half of the store from Mrs. Larkin's.
It's all a matter of showing them how much worse the alternative is,
Eloise said.
Getting fitted by Mr. Larkin is tedious, but Mrs. Larkin, now that would be wretched.
An indignant howl rent the air, and Oliver came running back in, straight to Eloise, which left Philip feeling a little bereft. He wanted his children to run to him, he realised.
He stuck me with a pin,
Oliver declared.
Were you squirming?
Eloise asked, without even batting an eyelash.
No, not even a little bit. Only the tiniest bit. Right then,
Eloise said.
don't move next time. I assure you that Mr. Larkin is very good at his job. If you don't move, you won't get jabbed. It's as simple as that."
Oliver digested that, then turned to Philip with a pleading look in his eyes. It was rather nice to be perceived as an ally, but Philip wasn't going to contradict Eloise and undermine her authority, especially not when he agreed with her wholeheartedly. But then Oliver surprised him. He didn't beg to be set free from Mr. Larkin's clutches, and he didn't say something horrid about Eloise, which, Philip was sure, he would have done just a few weeks earlier, about any adult who thwarted his wishes. Oliver just looked up at him and asked,
"Will you come with me, Father? Please?"
Philip opened his mouth to reply, but then, inexplicably, had to stop. His eyes began to sting with unshed tears, and he realised that he was, quite simply, overcome. It wasn't just the moment, the fact that his son wanted his company for a male rite of passage. Oliver had begged his company before, but this was the first time that Philip felt truly able to say yes, confident that if he went, he would do the right thing and say the right words. And even if he didn't, it wouldn't matter. He wasn't his father. Would never be. Could never be like him. He couldn't afford to be a coward, to keep pushing his children toward other people, all because he was worried he'd make a mistake. He would make mistakes. It was inevitable. But they wouldn't be huge ones. And with Eloise at his side, he was quite confident he could do anything. Even manage the twins. He placed his hand on Oliver's shoulder.
"I would be delighted to accompany you, son."
He cleared his throat, which had gone hoarse on the final word. Then he bent down and whispered,
"The last thing we want is women over on the men's side."
Oliver nodded his vigorous agreement. Philip straightened, preparing to follow his son back to Mr. Larkin's side of the establishment. Then he heard Eloise clearing her throat behind him. He turned, and she was gesturing with her head toward the back of the room. Amanda, looking very grown up in her new lavender frock, showing just a hint of the woman she would one day become. For the second time in as many minutes, Philip's eyes began to burn. This was what he'd been missing. In his fear, in his self-doubt, he'd been missing this. They'd been growing up without him. Philip patted his son on the shoulder to signal that he'd be right back, and then crossed the room to his daughter's side. Without a word, he picked up her hand and kissed it.
"You, Miss Amanda Crane," he said,
his heart in his eyes, his voice, his smile,
"are the most beautiful girl I have ever seen."
Her eyes grew wide, and her lips formed a tiny little O of sheer delight.
"What about Miss Mother?"
she whispered frantically. Philip looked over at his wife, who appeared close to tears herself, and then turned back to Amanda, leaning over to whisper in her ear,
"Let's make a deal, you and I. You can think your mother is the most beautiful woman alive, but I get to think it's you."
And later that night, after he'd tucked them into bed, kissed each on the forehead, and headed for the door, he heard his daughter whisper,
"Father."
He turned.
"Amanda?"
"This was the best day ever, Father,"
she whispered.
"Ever,"
Oliver agreed. Philip nodded.
"For me as well,"
he said softly.
"For me as well."
It started with a note. Later that night, as Eloise finished her supper and her plate was cleared away, she realised that there had been a piece of paper tucked underneath, folded twice until it formed a small rectangle. Her husband had excused himself, claiming that he needed to find a book that contained a poem they had been discussing over pudding. And so, with no one watching her, not even the footman, who was busy transporting the dishes to the kitchen,
Eloise unfolded the paper. "I have never been good with words," it said, in Philip's unmistakable handwriting. And then, smaller, in the corner, "Proceed to your office." Intrigued, she stood and exited the dining room. A minute later, she entered her office, and there, in the middle of her desk, was another piece of paper. But it all started with a letter, did it not? Followed by instructions to take herself to the sitting room. She did, this time having to concentrate quite hard on keeping her half-walk, half-skip from turning into a full-fledged run. A small piece of paper, again folded twice, sat on a red cushion positioned at the very centre of the sofa. And so, if it started with words, it ought to continue with them too. This time she was directed to the front hall. "But there are no words to thank you for all you have given me, so I will use the only ones at my disposal, and I will tell you the only way I know how." And at the bottom corner of the note, she was directed to her bedroom. Eloise headed up the stairs slowly, her heart beating with anticipation. This was her final destination. She was sure of it. Philip would be waiting for her, waiting to take her hand, to lead her into their future together. It had, she realized, all started with a note. Something so innocent, so innocuous, and it had grown into this. A love so full and rich she could barely contain it. She reached the upstairs hall, and on quiet feet made her way to the bedroom door. It was slightly ajar, just an inch or so, and with shaking hand she pushed it open all the way. And she gasped, for there on the bed were flowers, hundreds and hundreds of blooms, some clearly out of season, picked from Philip's special collection in his greenhouse, and written in blossoms of red against the backdrop of white and pink petals, "I love you." "Words aren't enough," Philip said softly, stepping out of the shadows behind her. She turned to him, barely cognizant of the tears trickling down her cheeks. "When did you do this?" He smiled. "Surely you'll allow me a few secrets." He took her hand, pulled her close. "Speechless," he murmured. "You? I must be better at this than I thought."
"I love you," she said, choking on the words. "I love you so much."
His arms came around her, and as she laid her cheek against his chest, his chin came down to rest gently on her head. "Today," he said softly, "the twins told me it was the best day ever, and I realized they were right." Eloise nodded, beyond words. "But then," he continued, "I realized they were wrong." She looked up at him, question in her eyes. "I couldn't choose a day," he confessed. "Any day with you, Eloise. Any day with you." He touched her chin, brought his lips to hers. "Any week," he murmured. "Any month, any hour." He kissed her then, softly, but with all the love in his soul. "Any moment," he whispered, "as long as I'm with you." Epilogue.
"There is so much I hope to teach you, little one. I hope that I may do so by example, but I feel the need to put the words to paper as well. It is a quirk of mine, one which I expect you will recognize and find amusing by the time you read this letter. Be strong, be diligent, be conscientious. There is never anything to be gained by taking the easy road, unless, of course, the road is an easy one to begin with. Roads sometimes are. If that should be the case, do not forge a new, more difficult one. Only martyrs go out looking for trouble. Love your siblings. You have two already, and God willing, there will be more. Love them well, for they are your blood,
and when you are unsure or times are difficult, they will be the ones to stand by your side. Laugh. Laugh out loud, and laugh often. And when circumstances call for silence, turn your laugh into a smile. Don't settle. Know what you want and reach for it. And if you don't know what you want, be patient. The answers will come to you in time, and you may find that your heart's desire has been right under your nose all the while. And remember, always remember, that you have a mother and a father who love each other and love you. I feel you growing restless. Your father is making strange gasping sounds, and will surely lose his temper altogether if I do not move from my escritoire to my bed. Welcome to the world, little one. We are all so delighted to make your acquaintance. From Eloise, Lady Crane, to her daughter, Penelope, upon the occasion of her birth. The End. This is Rosalind Landor. We hope you have enjoyed this production of To Sir Philip with Love by Julia Quinn. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories and more, so look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.